Best-selling author Mary Roach has dug deep, literally in some cases, into the science of dead bodies, sex, space, the afterlife, and our digestive systems. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Mary Roach about the path that took her from freelance writer to best-selling author to talking about space toilets on The Daily Show.
You haul the whole toilet up to Ellington Field, you put it on the plane, and some poor guy from the Waste Management Systems Department has to then test it. He's got it like 20 seconds. He's got 20 seconds.
Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Before Mary Roach published the book Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, the idea of a best-selling popular science book on the subject of dead bodies may have sounded like a non-starter. But Mary Roach is brilliant, she's funny, and her approach to science has made her a dream come true for nerds everywhere. She followed up Stiff with other fascinating books about scientific topics, her most recent being Gulp, Adventures on the Elementary Canal. She's in Iowa City to work with students at the University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program, and she's speaking tonight at 8 o'clock at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. That event is free and open to the public, and she's here with me in the studio this morning. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, and in the past couple of weeks, with the Pulitzer Prizes being awarded, there's been a lot of conversation in the world of journalism about people leaving journalism to go into public relations just because it's hard to make a living in journalism. You went the other direction.
I did.
You started out doing PR for a zoo and then also became a freelance writer on the side.
That's right. I started out partly because I didn't go to a wonderful program like the University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program. I didn't do that. I just graduated with a liberal arts degree and found myself sort of floundering around. You can write when you graduate, but one thing you can do when you have a bachelor's of arts is you can write. So I got this job at the San Francisco Zoological Society Public Affairs Office, which was really fun and delightful. I got to write. I wrote press releases and I wrote little magazine articles about the newest in laser surgery for elephant plantar warts, which are huge. It's a huge wart. And it's a lot of
I believe it. Yeah. If it's on an elephant, sure.
It kind of, in a way, maybe it shaped my career, but it was a lot of fun. And I worked in a trailer by Gorilla World, which also suited me well. It wasn't terribly corporate. And I did that half time and I wrote part time and then gradually went on to writing. But I think combining the two is a nice way for a young writer to start out. You have sort of a steady income, and then you can indulge your more creative passions on the side. And that worked well for me.
Now, I think a lot of people, given the subject matter of your books, assume that you have a scientific background. When did your interest in science really start?
I was writing for a number of magazines. One of them was called Hippocrates, and it no longer exists, but it was a wonderful, it was about medicine and health in the human body, but it took sort of a writerly approach, and they had a budget for travel, and they'd say, well, let's write about maybe meditation, and I'd go, okay, well, how could I make this interesting? And I'd stumble onto some news story about the president of Mozambique and how he's really into transcendental meditation, and he makes all his heads of cabinet meditate, the heads of the military are forced to take TM. And I thought, all right, I'm going to go to Mozambique and I'm going to talk to the president of Mozambique about meditation. And he actually he won't shut up. He loves to talk about it. So that would become the basis of the story. So that was about 10 years I wrote for that publication. Then I began writing for Discover. And that was just a sort of natural offshoot of the work I did for Hippocrates. So it was something that I was just passively doing my thing and wound up writing for Discover. And the stories for Discover, which still exist, were always so much fun and so fascinating. So I just was happy staying in the backyard of science and not really moving on to anything else. And it's been a...
Was there kind of an epiphany where you realized, wait, this is more fun than anything else I do?
It, Well, all along, because I was writing about medical topics, it was always very fun. I had a brief stint in the middle of that where someone had asked me to do celebrity profiles, and that was kind of quite a change. And I realized very quickly, this is not something I'm cut out to do. Although it was interesting in its own strange way, in politics, it's not. I don't like to interview people about things they don't want to talk about. I don't like people to get upset. I love to talk to scientists or people who they do something. They're immersed in this world, and maybe their spouse doesn't want to hear about it anymore. And they sit next to someone on an airplane, and they say, "Well, I do ergonomics for the airline companies," and people sort of zone out. Whereas I think, whoa, is there a lab with just lots of people sitting in airline seats? How cool is that? And which actually happened to me, and I got there and found out, yeah, it's a lab with a lot of people sitting in airline seats. It's not that interesting. But anyway, it was interesting, but not quite as...
Not maybe as exciting as some other labs.
Some other labs, exactly.
So I've read about sort of how Stiff, that first book, came about. And in a way, it was maybe not a dare, but tell us what happened.
Yeah, I'd been writing for magazines for 10, 15 years. I'd always thought about writing a book, but it seemed daunting. It seemed like any idea I'd think of was a magazine story and not a book. But I worked in an office with a bunch of writers called the San Francisco Writers Grotto. And every year, a bunch of us would get together and right after New Year's and make predictions secretly for other people in our office, some of them personal things and other career things. And someone made the prediction for me that I would have a book contract by the next New Year's. So around October, I realized this and I thought, oh, crap, I've got 3 months. I've got to sell a book. I've got to write a book proposal. So it was really, that's what lit the fire under me.
Really?
I was shamed into writing a book proposal because a book proposal is, nobody pays you to do it. It's never on your schedule,
right?
Write book proposal. So
did you already have an idea?
No, I didn't. Fortuitously, around that time, an agent had contacted me. I was writing a column for Salon.com, and he had called, sort of fishing around as agents do, said, "I like your writing style. Have you thought about writing a book?" And we had a conversation where he said, "Well, look at all of your Salon columns," which it was a reported column about the human body and health and kind of the and of course, I always migrate out to the fringes a bit. So there were a couple cadaver research columns, and those had the highest hit rates, which suggested that this was a topic that people were fascinated by. And I initially said, "Jay, what? Like, picture the scenario. It's a bookstore. You wander in. There's a whole table of new releases. Who's the person who's going to go, oh, this cadaver book right here, that's what I'm going to buy." I couldn't see it. I thought it was a terrible idea. He said, "I don't think so." He said, "Write up a short treatment, show me that." And then he suggested writing a proposal, and off it went. And in fact, people in the industry saw it as something that might be of interest to people.
Because it turns out it was.
We all do end up that way.
It's true. Now, did you, in coming up with that idea and writing the proposal, I mean, you really kind of throw yourself into your research for your books. Had you already developed that style of, I will go to a laboratory, I will see dead bodies, smell dead bodies, and find out all about them?
I was known, at one point, some editor referred to me as that woman in California who does stuff. So they would, they'd call me up and say, "Well, we need somebody to do a story on the common cold, like what's new in the common cold." Well, that can be a little dreary. So, I looked around, and there's in fact this place doesn't exist anymore, but in the UK called the Common Cold Unit, where you go and a bunch of Brits go to be subjects, but it's also their summer vacation because it's set in a lovely setting and near I think it's in Gloucester somewhere. And you go in and they drip a virus up your nose, and most of you will get it, but not all of you. And you get 3 meals a day, and it's lovely, and you can go for a walk, but you have to stay 30 feet from anyone else. So you carry a little string between you, and you walk through the fields developing a cold. And then every other day, the snot nurse comes in and has you blow into a petri dish to see if you're shedding virus, and they do research. And so that I went and was a subject there, and that was the first feature story I'd really done. So that became kind of partly because it was just tremendous fun for me. I would try to find some sort of way for me to immerse myself in it. And I think it was fun for the reader as well.
Now, we have a clip. This is from later in your career, after you wrote your most recent book, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. And this is, you've often been a guest on the public radio program Radiolab. And this is you talking about one of the things that you did for research.
You're standing there sort of normally. And for some reason, I've worn a skirt and kitten heels. And my hosts are wearing manure encrusted muck boots. And this is a source of great entertainment that
pearls.
I'm here. Yeah. And it's packed really tightly. You got to really work your arm. The guy I was with, Ed DePeters, he's like, no, keep going. I'm like, I don't know, Ed. I'm not sure, really.
Go further in or?
Yeah, keep going. And I'm literally up to my shoulder inside this cow.
All right. I guess we should have set that up first. But tell us what you were doing with your arm inside a cow.
Well, this wasn't just any cow. This was a fistulated cow. This is a cow who has almost, it looks like a gas cap on a car on the side, on its flank, but where, you know, over the rumen. And you open this up. It's a sort of plastic, kind of like a plug in. You know, those people who widen their earlobes and put a plug in. It's a little like that. It's and what I'm trying to say is it's not terribly painful for the, it's a stretching right. thing. And they have a plug. So you open it up and it allows you to put your hand and then your wrist and then your whole arm, if you wish to, into the rumen of a cow. And that was something I wanted to do. I was talking about, it was a chapter that had to do with the stomach. Now, the cow is it's a fermenter. It's a different kind of digestive system. It's like a composter in there. It's cooking. It's hot and it's packed. And the cow has these muscles that are kind of mixing everything around. And it's this very powerful contractions. I really thought I might break a finger. And so, and it was just an extraordinary experience. It was interesting that I have another chapter in that book about fecal transplants. Agriculture, for years before anybody thought of doing that with humans, they just take a little of the material from one cow, put it in another. They've been doing that for a long time, and it's very effective.
So if a cow has a bad digestion problem, they'll just take some bacteria from another cow, stick it in there.
Cured. Yeah.
So back when you were writing Stiff, and you wanted to visit these labs and started having the kind of adventures that show up in your books, did you have any trouble talking your way into places?
Yeah, I did. Sometimes I did. Particularly with Stiff, because people who do cadaver research, particularly back then, were and are a little bit wary about media exposure, because it's very easy to sensationalize it and to say, oh my God, they've got a bunch of people stacked in a freezer. It's terrible and disrespectful. It's like, well, what would you do with a bunch of dead bodies? You're stacking them up, is that a bad thing? You know, sometimes I would get calls from, you know, television people going, oh, my God, they're dead. And I'd say, no, you don't have a story. There's nothing wrong. Anyway, people in that business or who have to work with cadavers can be a little wary. And who am I? I'm some, Reader's Digest columnist type weirdo.
We'll talk more about it in a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with best-selling author Mary Roach. She is speaking tonight at 8 p.m. at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Mary Roach. She is the author of a number of best-selling books on scientific subjects, such as Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, that came out in 2008, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void in 2010. She is in Iowa City to work with students at the University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program, and she's speaking tonight at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City at 8 o'clock. That is open to the public. And this hour, if you have a question for Mary Roach, you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So with that first book, with Stiff, you said people were kind of wary about letting you into their laboratories. After that book became so high profile, did that get a lot easier for you when you started looking for scientists who wanted to talk to you?
It did, and I didn't expect that. I actually thought it might go the other way, because when you're a scientist and you're involved, you're passionate about your work. Your work is very complex. I come in and I'm simplifying it, and I'm zeroing in on details that perhaps are not that interesting or important to you. And so I had a sense that people would like be very would tend to avoid me. Like, I don't want to be Mary Roachized. But in fact, people have been so welcoming, and it's been really nice. I don't show them the chapter beforehand. It's usually somebody's the focus of a chapter, and I don't give it to them to check, because you'll never get done that way.
Right.
Because people say, "Did I say that? Really, what I wanted to talk about was this." And can we,
my boss says that I was supposed to say this.
And the human resources people. But there was one case, because it was a NASA cadaver study, and NASA was very uncomfortable just with death in general. And with everything, because they're taxpayer funded and they just don't want it to make any waves, and so they didn't want me to cover this. And so the researcher, he was a contractor. He said, "I'd really like to see it." And so I did send him the whole chapter, and he said, "Well, yeah." He sent me an email. He said, "The first thing I did when I read it, I thought I better get my CV together because this is it for me." And then he said, "I read it again with my Mary Roach goggles on," and I thought, "Okay, this is all right." There was one line he wanted me to take out. There was a point where he made a joke about driving through the high occupancy lane with cadaver, and he didn't actually have the cadaver set up in the car to get it to go through the carpool lane. But just the fact that he had joked about it, he felt that would make him seem. So we took that out, and now I've shared it.
Right.
And his name is John Bolte.
And it sounds like he's a funny guy.
He's very respectful of his bodies. But anyway.
So in inserting yourself into these situations and having some adventures, I mean, for your book, Bonk, you and your husband volunteered to be part of, well, some cuddling research and some more intimate research as well. Do you have any concerns going into these situations?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm the kind of person that says yes. And then doesn't really give it much thought until it's too late to back out.
It's tomorrow.
Yeah, it's like, oh, did I actually agree to do that? For Bonk, and it's an interesting, this was a study, I should, back up. It was a study in London, University of London, I think it was. And there it was a 3D ultrasound imaging study, because a three-dimensional ultrasound imaging, it's a way for a surgeon to be able to kind of preview what he'll be working on, and so it's a very useful technique, and it was just being developed. They also do it with CT scans, I believe. Anyway, he wanted to, and it's moving, it's a movie, so he was looking at things like how a lip moves, or he had actually done one. This is what caught my eye. He'd done one on an erecting penis, and then he mentioned he would like to actually do one on intercourse, and he is legitimate. I must point out to the audience here, he's legitimate. This was a peer-reviewed journal. And I said, "Oh, hello, I'd like to be there for this historic event. Could I come and be there when you film this couple?" And he wrote back, "Well, dear Dr. Roach," which always cracks me up because I don't have a PhD. He says, I'd be happy to oblige, but we're having trouble finding a brave couple for intimate study. So if you're organization can provide one, I'd be happy to set it up." So my organization had to call its husband and say, "Hey, you know how you said you haven't been to London for 25 years? And let's go. And we'll go take some plays in the West End. We can go out to Stonehenge. We have to have sex in front of a guy in a lab coat." And so I did have a lot of, on the one hand, I thought this will be wonderful material. Whatever it is, it's going to be very awkward. I may regret it while it's going on, but when I come out of it, I'm going to have this wonderful writing experience, and hopefully the reader will have a wonderful reading. So I was both
right. So
dreading
see,
it and...
I see what you would get out of that.
Oh, Ed?
What about your husband?
Yeah, Ed. Ed got nightmares. Ed had said in the beginning, "Oh, sex research, sign me up," when I started the book. And he's a tremendously good sport, but he didn't. That was because, of course, the burden of performance is on him. You know, I'm taking notes throughout the whole thing. I'm not. It was very strange sex. It was barely even sex, and yeah, he came out of it and he's like, I feel really weird that I was even able to do that, so I took him out to a very expensive, delicious meal in London to try to make up for it.
Was that the most uncomfortable experience you've inserted yourself into as research?
Yes. I can say absolutely, unequivocally, yes. That was.
What's been the most fun?
Oh, the most fun was packing for Mars. I got myself on as a journalist on it's a zero gravity or simulated weightless. It's a weightlessness flight. It's a jet that goes in a kind of a roller coaster pattern in the sky, and as it goes over and down, plummeting down,
you
don't look
float,
out the window.
Right?
You float for about 20, 25 seconds, and that was amazing. That was just I've always wanted to do that, and it was it's an amazing feeling because you don't realize that your organs inside you confer a sensation. So when suddenly they're weightless, you have this feeling of being free of a sensation that you didn't even realize existed. So it's this kind of physical euphoria. You don't weigh anything. Nothing weighs anything.
Do you feel empty?
No, you just feel utterly relaxed. Well, being in water, it's that times 100. So it's wonderful. Everybody's laughing. It's very giddy, and your notebook is floating in front of you, and the pages are all fanned out. And I was on there to be reporting on a number of students from a university. They're aerospace engineering students, and they're working on a rig that they're poor. They have to be working while they're up there, and I'm supposed to be reporting on them. I think on my notebook, all it says is "woohoo," and I was just floating above them, kind of getting in the way. And I wasn't the most attentive journalist at that point.
Now, I mean, what has really set your work apart from a lot of other people's work? I mean, for one thing, it's the humor. It's just incredibly funny, which makes it very, very readable. But you also really do an incredible job as a journalist reporting science accurately and being able to understand. And if anybody reads a lot of science journalism, there's a lot of bad science journalism out there, and your science journalism is very good science journalism. So is there anything about your approach? Because, I mean, sometimes journalists are also scientists. You're not. What do you do? Because you must go into situations where you really have no idea what they're going to be talking about and no background.
That's true. I make it hard for myself in that I don't have a background. What I do is I tend to treat my subjects, the people who are my sources, I just tend to treat them as unpaid tutors. And I sit them down and say, I'm sorry, I don't have a background in this. Can we just go over some very basic things? And I think they must, some of them, be shocked at the level of my ignorance.
Right, and maybe a little nervous about what will come out at the end, I would
guess.
Yes,
I think they are. I think, and I do reassure people that I'll go over, I don't show them the whole chapter, but I do a fact check. Well, I'll contact them and make sure that I do have things right. But yeah, it's very kind of them to trust me with this because I don't have a background and some of it is complex. Then again, I'm limiting myself to, it's a very narrow sliver of science. Most of science now has gone microscopic and beyond. It's protein receptors and genetics and it's enzymes and things that are not. And I'm a bodies on the slab kind of gal. I'm really covering such a tiny chunk of science because that's the area where my interests lie and my expertise. I am very much limited by my lack of background. But on the other hand, I'm coming at it with the same sense of curiosity and wonder. I'm the kind of person that I remember learning how the bladder works, stretch receptors. This idea that, oh, well, there's this sac and you start to fill it up with liquid and it stretches out. And then it activates these stretch receptors, which tell your brain, oh, time to start pulling over and looking for a bathroom.
Where's the rest area?
Yeah. But that, I was like, stretch receptors, that's beautiful. I love that. So whereas if you're a urologist, I mean, you're so far beyond stretch receptors and filling bladders. That's before first year medicine. So I have a kind of a relationship with the reader. That I don't have to second guess, am I speaking in too complex a way? Am I using too much jargon?
So it's a strength as well.
Yeah, it's a strength and a weakness, yeah.
I'm talking with Mary Roach, best-selling author of many books on scientific issues. Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal is her most recent. Also, you mentioned Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void, number of fabulous books. She is speaking tonight at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City. And you're welcome to join our conversation this hour. If you have questions for Mary Roach, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Now, once you have done all of this research and written all of this stuff about these different topics, then, you know, you end up getting interviewed about these topics, and not necessarily about your work as a writer, but about the topics that you report on. Then do people start treating you as if you are the scientist behind all of this research?
They do, yeah. Particularly with Bonk, which was a book about sex labs and the study of sexual physiology, which is an awkward prospect. But that one, because I did a TED Talk, and the when you do a TED Talk, you're not supposed to promote yourself, so they don't mention your book. They don't say that you're an author. Suddenly, you're on a stage, and you're talking about, in my case, orgasm. And this went out onto the internet, and the week after it went live on the internet, I got a tremendous number of emails from all over the world, people assuming that I'm a researcher, and just some of them delightful. Like, there was one of the first ones I got was hello, I'm a 49-year-old man living in Greece, and I have an orgasm when I ride a bicycle, and I ride my bicycle to work, and because I know this will happen, I ride in circles. Sometimes it makes me late. Sometimes I think it's the anxiety produced by being late. And it was this whole description, and then he just ended saying, I thought you might want to know this for your research. So I got a lot of, but the other, lightweight side of it, I would get also letters from mostly women saying, I can't have an orgasm. What do you recommend? You know, and I'm not a therapist. I'm not a physiologist. You know, so that's a little awkward sometimes when people come to me for help with a problem, and I'm not an expert. I just play one on paper.
So what do you do? Do you answer those emails? Do you write them back and say, you know, this is the book that I wrote and other people are researching this? And
I try to refer them to people who can perhaps help them. So with Gulp, there was a chapter on fecal transplants, or bacteria therapy, as it's more politely known. And this is it's a treatment that's used for chronic C. diff, and C. difficile is an infection and sets up housekeeping in the colon and can be very difficult to get rid of, and it can be fatal. And I got a number of emails from people saying, you know, I don't know where to go to. I want to try this. And at the time I wrote the book, it was still under review by the FDA. It wasn't going on in a lot of places. So the researcher that I spoke to had been kind enough to give me a list of physicians and hospitals where a person might be able to get this. So I try to help if I can and refer them to someone who might know more or who could actually do a procedure.
Well, let's hear another clip here. This is from an appearance that you did on The Daily Show, and this was after you published Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void, and discovered that people are endlessly fascinated by space toilets. So let's listen to that.
You mentioned, if I may, fecal decapitation.
Yes, yes, yes. This is an issue with the shuttle toilet. All right, what's that? What's going on? Is it's airflow, and it's flash frozen, so it's very hard. And you know, picture an air popper for popcorn, okay?
Okay.
Okay. So you've got like stuff can start little pieces bouncing around, you know, it might zero gravity might be what they call an escapee, which means it goes.
If I may, is that what NASA refers to them as?
Yes, yes.
An escapee. We got a runner.
There is a rear view mirror on the shuttle toilet so that you can glance, you know, see if there's, you know, an escapee. Because that's bad news
But what are you going to do, lasso it? I mean, if you see it, what do you then do at that point?
You then have to, yes, you chase it down. It is your responsibility.
So that's Mary Roach from a clip on The Daily Show talking about Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. People are really interested in space toilets, it turns out. Have there been things like that? Has that surprised you, the amount of interest in one particular topic that you've written about?
No, because I was so interested as well. That was one of the first things that got me interested in even doing a book. It was years and years ago. So it was for a story for Vogue magazine about osteoporosis. And I had contacted a NASA researcher who was looking into bone loss, which the astronauts have to deal with because they're not using their skeletons. And of course, we went off topic, which always happens when I call someone. I'm not, you know, osteoporosis. Okay, yeah, it's interesting. But I somehow asked about space toys. And this guy, Dr. William Thornton, he told me about this toilet with a video camera that's a trainer, a positional trainer for astronauts so that they can, basically, they're docking with the toilet. They're coming in because you don't sit down. You're floating. You're weightless. You can't sit down in the toilet. So the whole, the idea of a toilet, I mean, it's so complicated. It's this wonderful engineering slash biological challenge. And he told me about this toilet. And 25 years later, it stayed with me. I thought, maybe space, maybe something about space. But it
so
was
the,
that
the toilet was where it began.
The toilet was where it began.
Oh, my goodness. We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with best-selling author Mary Roach. Some of her books, Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. She's in Iowa City right now to work with students at the University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program. And she's speaking tonight at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City at 8 o'clock. That is open to the public. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today is best-selling author Mary Roach. She has written many books on scientific subjects, including Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal. I had to pick one off the list. There's too many, too many here. She's with me today because she's in Iowa City to work with students at the University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program. And Mary, when, you know, people dream of becoming an author, I suppose, I mean, they dream of becoming a best-selling author, and they dream of invitations to be on something like The Daily Show or The Colbert Report. And of course, you are all and continue to be all over NPR. NPR adores you with good reason. But is that a little, when it actually happens, is that a little scary when you know you're going on a show that's supposed to be funny? And your books are very funny, but they are also scientific. So is that scary?
It's terrifying. It's both, you're both overjoyed and terrified. I mean, when I've heard that, I mean, I'm a huge fan of The Daily Show. I love Jon Stewart. I had met him very briefly at the Book Expo America. He was the MC of a panel, and I went to, in the green room, and I went up to him, and I was almost in tears. It's so important what you do. Like the people with him were like, are we going to have a situation here? So to go on the show was, I mean, I was jumping up and down. I was so excited, and then realized, it has to be wonderful. What if it's not? What if I suck? So, it's Terry. And Terry Gross, I mean, I wasn't on Fresh Air until my most recent book. So there was a lot of buildup, a lot of time to get get nervous about, wow, this is it. And fortunately, you know, it's taped. So if I really humiliated myself and tripped over my words, it could be expunged.
Unlike today,
where I'm just humiliating myself over and over.
But you went on the Colbert Report without actually understanding what the Colbert Report was.
Yeah, it was the second week of the program. I was on book tour. My husband would call me up and say, Mary, you really need to see at least one show before you go on. It's not your typical show. And I hadn't seen, I at that point wasn't watching the Daily Show. I hadn't seen Colbert in action. And I watched one episode, which was the Ken Burns fake documentary about interviewing Ken Burns that Colbert did. And it was funny, but it didn't give me a sense of his persona. So I didn't know when I went on, you need to just push back. You need to be as obnoxious as he's being. And I wasn't ready for it. It was okay, but they didn't ask me back.
Which book was that for?
That was for Spook.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, and it was kind of a stunt where he wanted to do a fake seance, and Jon Stewart's head appeared through the magic of special effects. The audience could see it, but I'm such a boob. I'm sitting in the chair looking like, where's his head? And everybody's laughing like, why are they what? So it was not a high point in my publicity career.
So you followed up Stiff with Spook. And, you know, Stiff is a very scientific-based book about cadavers. And then you decide to tackle the science of the afterlife. Mm-hmm. That, in some ways, that sounds like a tremendous risk to go from something that, you know, very fact-based to less fact-based.
Well, it was, yes. And that was part of what interested me was, it's a book about people trying to use scientific method to look at something that's in the realm of the spiritual and the religious. And that was the people and the creativity that was applied. It was part historical and part present day. And there still are 5 or 6 universities around the world that have a parapsychology program. So really, it's a parapsychology book more than anything. It's not a spiritual book. People think that it is because of the subtitle has afterlife. And they think, oh, Mary kind of lost her way there. But it is it's really very much in keeping with the other books. It's a sort of a romp through these labs and these people who, you know, I love that people are still, some people are able to get funding to look at things that just are kind of absurd and, you know, but, you know, the afterlife or the soul or the spirit, people are trying to, you know, it was a near-death experience. There's a program at the University of Virginia, there's a tremendous endowment the University of Virginia has specifically to study the persistence of personality after death. The inventor of the Xerox machine, Chester Carlson, his wife was very into spiritual matters, left a ton of money to the university and said, but you can only use it for this. And the university at a certain point have stopped even talking about it. The people I interviewed later told me they're not allowed any longer to even speak about what they do. But they're lovely people and they get a lot of grief and they're not treated seriously by their fellow professors. And so it's an interesting world to step into. But yeah, it was definitely feels like a departure.
Now, you're obviously fascinated by the research that you write about. But one of the things that makes your book so enjoyable is that you are also fascinated by the people who have done this research. And you seem to have a particular weakness for some of these early pioneers in fields. I mean, because now there are a lot of rules governing scientific research. And there was a time when it was kind of a free for all.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Very much so. And sometimes the free for all involved animals. And so some of those experiments are just, they're kind of amazing. And I want to include them. And I'm always, I forget how emotional people get. When I do get a letter from someone who's upset or concerned or had a negative takeaway from the book, it is often a reference to an animal study that happened in the 1800s, something like that. So, but there was definitely a sense. I mean, the first fecal transplant, this was done, I don't know, 70s. I'm forgetting the exact date, but it was Dr. Eisman. And I said, well, how did you, yeah, that's kind of a maverick thing to do, to take one person's fecal material, you know, throw it in a blender, put it in someone else. And he said, well, back then, this was a time when if you had an idea and it seemed like it might work, you went ahead and tried it.
Well, it's interesting that, I mean, I understand why people would be upset about some of the animal studies, but some of the things that were done to people were equally as inhumane.
I mean, particularly,
I'm thinking about in Gulp, and right now the names are escaping me, but the man who did research on his servant, who basically had a hole in his stomach.
William Beaumont and Alexis St. Martin. Yes, this was William Beaumont. He was an army surgeon. And there was a local fur trapper who, by an accident, had a hole in his side. And it was a window into his stomach. And Beaumont realized, not only is this a window into a stomach, this is a ticket to my career and my fame. And nobody's done this. And so it was this kind of dance back and forth where he treated St. Martin. And so because he was treating him, he felt he could do this. And then he had to pay him and St. Martin would take off and then he'd pay him more money and St. Martin would come back. But yeah, so the ethics of it were fascinating. The relationship between those two was really interesting to me. It was kind of a mutual dependency. But nowadays, yeah, you don't keep some guy around the house as a houseboy. And oh, by the way, other duties as assigned, I get to stick food in a little silk mesh bag in your stomach and then pull it back out and look at what's left. You know, that's just not something you can ask your servants to do, typically.
So you have really, a tremendous following. And I was looking online at a bunch of different interviews you've done, and I was struck by the tone of some of the questions that came from readers. I mean, and one of them was something like, you know, how do we get kids excited about science? We don't need more sociologists. We don't need more artists. We don't need more this or that. We need more scientists. How do we get people excited about it? And I'm curious. That made me curious about your feelings about, you know, we have this lack of science literacy in our populace. And now, over the past few years, a real focus on this STEM education to sort of compensate for that lack of science literacy, but also for the lack of scientists. You're not a scientist.
Right,
so,
right.
So how do you come down on this movement?
I think of myself, and I didn't come up, someone else came up with this, as a gateway drug to science. I don't have the expertise I can't be the instructor, I can't be the person teaching, but I can hopefully reach some. High school kids often read STIF. It's a summer reading. That don't ask me how that happened, but it's on summer reading lists or it's assigned to high school kids. So sometimes I hear from them, and they express surprise. I didn't think science was interesting. I thought this would be boring, and I really enjoyed it. It's really cool. And those are the best letters to me because then every now and then I'll hear from someone who says I'm going to apply to medical school or I want to become a pathologist. And that is what it's all about for me. You know, it's like, that's one more for our team. We got one. It's so exciting. I'm then turning it over to the real scientists, the teachers, the professors, the professionals, you know, who educate and who, you know, carry this student, you know, all the way through.
Right.
So I'm just kind of the barker.
Well, the tone of that one question, and of course, it's just one question, but it made me kind of wonder because, of course, the reason that you are so effective at communicating these scientific ideas to the public, to the people who read your books, is because you are an excellent writer. And sometimes I wonder if we've gone too far in the other direction. You know, maybe we were turning out too many liberal arts majors, but now suddenly writing and some of those arts seems to be so much less valued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, the writing is important. You know, sometimes I remember I was at a party and I was talking to someone about there was the story that I was doing for a bicycling magazine and they were sending me somewhere to participate. And this man was a bicyclist and he said, "But why would they send you? You don't even have a nice bicycle. Why would they?" And I said, "Well, I'm a writer, I guess. That matters. I don't know. They should have sent you."
Except he couldn't have told the story like you told the story.
Presumably. I don't know. I haven't read his work.
Right,
maybe secretly he's a but yeah, anyway, the writing does it does matter that's what gets people to finish the book. I write with a sense always of the person, the reader, being about to put down the book and go on to something else. People are so busy and distracted. So I'm always policing my writing for, is it funny? Is it fresh? Is it surprising? Will it make people go, wow, and read it aloud to the person that they're sitting next to? And that all is how books get read. And if there's science in the book, that's how science gets talked about and thought about and hopefully inspires someone to go into a career. And it's so important.
Earlier, we were talking about science journalism and there, you know, there's terrific science journalism. There's really poor science journalism. And as somebody with a science background, I used to be extremely frustrated reading in newspaper articles about climate change. And, you know, this is a well-documented problem where people without science backgrounds were writing about climate change and giving equal weight to people who said, nope, it's just not real, to the people who had spent their entire lifetimes researching it and actually had, you know, stuff that they could point to and share if the journalists could understand it. Are you worried about our lack of ability to understand in journalism?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, very much so. I worry about my own ability to get it right. Because I lack the big picture background, I'm always skating on thin ice with what I do. I don't, I have other people read the book just to, you know, people who are experts to be sure I'm not leaving out something critical, or, you know, it may be line by line accurate, but I'm missing somehow a big picture, and that's important. I would like to simultaneously have a terrific level of expertise and not I feel the same way. I mean, and particularly, you know, science journalism, the other thing going on is that the turnaround is so fast. You can't be an expert in all of science.
Right.
As a science journalist, you're taking in so much and you're having to turn it around so fast, and you don't have the luxury of a fact checker like a magazine has. A magazine piece is thoroughly fact checked. People call up the sources, and with science journalism in newspapers, I mean, I'm endlessly impressed by how good they get it, even if there are things that are left out or not quite accurate. That's more than I could do. So good for them.
Well, I have read a lot of scientific papers, and in reading your work, I think you must have a tremendous ability to sift through what many people would consider to be extraordinarily boring stuff to find the good parts.
I am a giant filtration system. That is what I do. I'm not a writer. For Bonk. One day I went into the basement of UCSF Medical School Library, and I sat down in front of a wall of the Journal of Sex Research, and I just started in 1858 or whenever they started, and I just scanned the table of contents. Boring, 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 boring. Oh, wow. sexual intercourse is a potential cure for intractable hiccups. I need to go to the Xerox machine and make a copy of that. That's really, whoa, what's that about? So yeah, I am sifting through, but that's also a weakness in that I'm going for the glittery stuff, the sparkly, shiny stuff. I'm you know, someone who's covering is a real science journalist who's covering a beat, who is making it timely, and who's writing about news, you know, and things that are very complex now. I have the luxury to pick and choose the goofy stuff, the weird stuff. It's an indulgence in a way, what I do.
Well, and I think it gets people to look at the other stuff too. So
hopefully, yes. Hopefully.
So I'm looking at your list of books, and I notice a pattern. 2003, 2005. The most recent one was in 2013. Is there something? No pressure.
Yeah. Yes, there is a book that I'm grappling with. I'm wrestling. I hope to be done writing it by the end of summer, but we'll see how that goes. And I'm sorry, I'm not really talking about the topic. I find it hard. My books are so sprawling, it's hard to sum them up neatly when I'm working on them. But there is another book in the works.
All right. Well, we can't wait for that. And we haven't talked at all about the fact that you're spending this time working with students at the University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program. Do you have one piece of advice that you consider to be most important for aspiring writers?
In nonfiction, yeah. In nonfiction, for me, the research is so critical. If I don't have the good material, the interesting person, the setting and the scene and the facts, if I don't have that package, the writing suffers. So the writing, I'm a writer, but I'm so dependent on the research, and I spend so, it's very front heavy. You want to find the people and the places and the stories that will make your writing and your book interesting and funny or surprising or whatever it is. So it's for me, writing is more about research.
Mary Roach, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bestselling author Mary Roach. She is the author of many books. Her most recent, Gulp Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, is out in paperback. There will be another book in the not-too-distant future. We hope she is in Iowa City to work with students in the University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program, and she'll be appearing tonight at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City at 8 p.m. That event is free and open to the public. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.